Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I am Laszlo Kovács. I'm the president of the Central and Eastern European Development Society. Welcome all to today's event, which is a panel discussion on the consequences of the European Union enlargement. Let me take this opportunity to welcome our panelists of today. Let me start with Her Excellency, Ms. Kaja Teel, Ambassador of Estonia. His Excellency, Mr. Béla Szombati, Ambassador of Hungary. His Excellency, Istok Mirosic, Ambassador of Slovenia. His Excellency, Stefan Füle, Ambassador of the Czech Republic. And Mr. Cezary Król, Minister Consular of Poland. Please welcome our guest speakers today. As some of you might remember, last year, around the same time, we had a similar meeting. It was just before the actual European Union enlargement, before the 1st of May. Then we were facing certain challenges, certain issues, issues of minority groups, issues of foreign policy, issues of sovereignty. We have seen the past 9 months, and we have seen that this was great improvement to the economies of these countries. They managed to produce GDP growth over 4.6% on average. Some of the Baltic states on average managed to get more than 6% growth, which is a very, very large number compared to the Eurozone, which has an average of about 1.8%. That's for the economies. But there are a lot more and numerous issues that are of concern and will be of concern from this point onwards. For this reason, let me take the opportunity to introduce our first speaker again, His Excellency Stefan Füle, who will start off the panel discussion. And then onwards, we will be going one by one, and the Q&A session will follow afterwards. So let's get started.
If I may use this microphone. Is it on? Definitely on. And it's working. Excellent. Good afternoon. As a sign of flexibility, we have just agreed a minute ago that I'll try to lead the discussion, putting in front of you in the most illustrative way the experience of the Czech Republic, and I'll try to generalize, to reflect the overall experience of our region, which would probably give us a chance then in the subsequent talks and discussion to focus on the concrete issues which are of the relevance either for all of us or individual countries. So again, glad to be here. It has been only a couple of months since the 1st of May. Definitely a short period for an in-depth analysis, but I think enough of time to make a certain overview of check and balances of what's happened since the 1st May, since we joined the European Union. EU is like an open area. You have to be fit to enter and even fitter to be a player. So it's really still for us still exercising our muscles within the European Union. Strikingly, looking back, what has happened on the 1st of May 2004, I think many of my colleagues would agree that really not that much. And the reason is that a huge amount of work has been done even before the 1st of May. In some cases 2 years, in some cases 3 years of the accession negotiations and the transposition of the European acquis is what I'm referring to. Still a lot of things ahead us. Schengen, hopefully all of us joining somewhere 2007, 2008, all of us joining the euro, in the case of the Czech Republic, 2009-2010, we did not have any chance to ask for opt-out, so both Schengen and euro for us is not the question if, but it's question when. Let me now first go through the following structure. What happened? What has not happened? Third, what is the current situation? And the fourth, what's ahead? What's in the future? Very short, very illustrative. So what happened? I think in all of our countries, the EU membership has been excellent for our administration. Membership has brought stabilization, greater effectiveness, and more openness to competition. That's the first. Second, very good for public awareness of interconnected world where the EU is more and more real player. Three, absolutely good for intensification of bilateral relations with individual EU members, deepening our mutual understanding, exchanges, inflow of new ideas, new points, languages, customs, culture and enrichment, diversity. Four, definitely good for our economies. Our economy is booming twice as fast as the older member states. By the way, I could mention that in the case of one region, the Prague, the per capita GDP exceeds by large 100% of the EU level. So it's not really only a region of or the number of the countries of poor regions. And I would call them many other points, positive one which happened, and let me mention the one more simple, traveling with only our IDs, no passport, abolishing the customs at the borders, which is definitely good for a free movement of the goods, definitely bad for our villages and cities on the highways, because the traffic as far as the Czech Republic has increased by 30%. I'm talking about the big trucks. So that's what's happened, what's positive. What has not happened? Or let me say what's a result of these five things. Despite a certain jet lag in a certain area, it's definitely overall positive feel in the society. What has not happened? The previous fears have not materialized, like increase of the prices. And one thing which is really relevant to our relationship to the United Kingdom, and it is that we have not witnessed tens of thousands of people of one ethnic minority moving into this country, misusing the free movement of labor force, misusing the social benefits, misusing the NHS system, and so on. On the contrary, I think we witness more and more positive articles in recent weeks that the decision to make the access to the labor market available to the new countries was beneficial to both sides of the UK and the new members. In fact, we like to refer to the Czech Republic, to the people coming here, that they are sort of coming on the understanding or reflecting the phrase learn, earn, and return. And this is exactly what's going on with most of the Czechs, and not only Czechs, coming to the UK. What we face as of today, that's my third point, actually reflecting on the togetherness, day-by-day business, dealing with a normal day-by-day subject, many of them in a similar way as the UK, I'm sure we will touch that in the subsequent discussion. And of course, also still finalizing our homework as transpositioning the rest of the EU law, where we still might have some legislation to be converted into our national legislation. What's ahead? For all of us, probably the most important are two issues. It is the constitutional treaty and the debate. We have two of our countries who already ratified the constitutional treaty, not in all new members. The discussion is going to be as smooth as it was the case in Lithuania and Hungary. The second issue as a priority for all of us definitely is a financial perspective. And it is reflecting in the financial perspective for the years 2007 and 2013 the adequate amount of resources to help the real convergence of our regions, of our economies. Thanks very much. I think that's for the introduction, a very short one, as I said, illustrative, might be just exactly what I wanted to say.
Well, thank you very much, Her Excellency.
Thank you. Well, in contrast to Stefan, and I suppose it has been the idea to parade all of us here and to display some of the differences between us. So, in contrast to Stefan, I'm actually going to talk a little bit about some really topical economic issues in the European Union. So bear with me as for some details, but I'm sure an audience in LSE would be perfectly able to follow this. So I'm not talking about the real economic impact of the European Union enlargement. I mean, this we really don't know anything of yet. We can't even talk about reliable statistics at the moment. But what has happened is that all of us have been actively participating in the future financing debates, for example. So this is exactly what the Czech ambassador referred to in his closing remarks. So I will touch a little bit upon the Estonian position as for the financial perspective. Also, economic issues are a bit paradoxical for most of our countries. I mean, the enlargement of the European Union has been kind of advertised as for a very big economic boost. Now, in most of our countries, as the chairman kindly pointed out in the beginning, the growth rate has actually been much higher than in the European Union average. Because we obviously essentially still are economies in transition. Now, a good growth rate, a healthy growth rate, would be quite a good thing, you might think, at least nothing to be ashamed of. Now, in reality, this projects all sorts of problems for the new member states. Starting from very different economic policies, which in a way create even ideological problems in the European Union. There is a clear watershed between very liberally thinking member states and those countries who have chosen a different path. And I will touch upon this a little bit later. But it also translates into very real problems in things like future financing. So to just exemplify this with quite a detailed aspect, when we are talking about structural and cohesion funds in the European Union, you know that the general principle is that any country whose GDP is lower than 75% is entitled to European Union assistance. Now, the general idea has been that this assistance should not exceed 4% of the relevant country's GDP, just because it has been the practice that the country is not really able to absorb more than that, which is a very healthy principle. But as for the GDP, at the moment, for example, the assistance is calculated on the basis of the GDP growth on average, which means the Commission has proposed a growth for the Baltic states, for example, around 4%. In reality, all sorts of statistical analysis will show that we are expecting a growth rate of about 6% on average. Now, the difference between 4% and 6% will make a real difference in real money. So in a way, the Baltic states are probably going to be wealthier soon than the European Union thinks. On the other hand, during this process of catching up, the Baltic states are going to receive the least amount of assistance per capita. Now, this is a bit paradoxical, but as I said, economies can be, the key issue of economy can be quite paradoxical for a country like Estonia, where we have had to deliberalize for joining the European Union already. Well, we do understand that there is a price to pay joining this club of social stability, security, and so on. So we are happy with this. But we are a little bit worried that we would like to sustain our economic growth, and we're not quite sure if this is going to happen. And that's why we fought together with the UK, for example, in the convention for keeping direct taxes in the national competence. Because we do really believe that this is not only an economic issue, it's also an issue on sovereignty. Every country should have the right, it should be up to their voters to decide how much of the generated wealth is actually going to be redistributed. And taxes, as you know, are a very powerful instrument in the government's hands for promoting economic growth, for promoting, among other things, investment. And as for Estonia, we are really an economy which is geared towards growth and which is very investment friendly. Now, for example, one of our economical features is the so-called zero rate tax on reinvested corporate income, which actually has produced very good results already. But I'm sad to say it has also produced a very hot debate in the European Union, and Estonia has been effectively pilloried for this. And there is a lot of political spin about this. I mean, it's very good for some heads of government to go around and say that our taxpayer is not going to open the purse to support Estonia's social system. Now, that's good, but who has asked you to? I mean, nobody in the European Union is actually paying into the budget with the explicit purpose of supporting each other's social systems. And this kind of a debate creates really unwelcome perceptions. For us, the most important thing is that even if we have this one specific aspect of the tax system of zero rate on reinvested corporate income, it does not mean at all that the overall tax burden is somewhat peculiarly low. It does not mean either that our social security system underachieves just because our tax revenues are not high enough. Actually, the experience shows exactly the opposite. With our system of flat income tax, with no real legal loopholes, the revenues have been much higher than before. So we would certainly say that in the European Union, we are quite willing to share our practices in taxation and show off our quite a sustainable economic system. Now, I promise to speak a little bit about the next financial perspective. You might have heard that there is a big fight at the moment as for how low or how high the budget of the European Union is going to be. Is the ceiling going to be set at 1% as the club of six is advocating 1% of the overall GDP, I mean? Or is it going to be 1.24, 1.26, something like the Commission is proposing? Now, Estonia, interestingly enough, is somewhere in the middle. We, in a way, it would be perfectly logical for us to join this club of six because their arguments in general are quite valid. They are saying that the Commission principally just has not explained the budget enough, and there are certain areas where we actually can economize. And as Estonia is always for liberal and transparent economic policies, we would go for this. We would understand that we can economize if we restructure the common agricultural policy, if we restructure the own resources system in the European Union, and so on and so on. At the same time, we really do not believe it will happen in the next financial perspective. So we have done our calculations, and we think a middle way of 1.1 is something which is going to be quite sufficient for keeping up rational cohesion policies, rational neighborhood policies, rational R&D investment, and so on. But I think there is quite a lot of room of compromise yet, and generally speaking, we are very happy to have a seat at the table and try to hammer it out. Thank you.
Thank you very much. His Excellency, Ambassador of Hungary, you may continue.
Well, thank you. Some of the things have already been said, looking at the title of our meeting today, which says 9 months later. So I thought of when we were last here, at least some of us were last here about a year ago or so, and what we said about the expectations, about what we thought enlargement or joining the European Union would bring for us and bring for the old member countries. And I'm sure I said something like we expect additional tools to our modernization efforts, and we also thought that we would contribute to the competitiveness of the European Union, on the other hand, speaking in economic terms. And also I'm sure I said that we would expect to have a stronger say in what's going on in Europe, but also in the European neighborhood. And so I'll add an additional element here about the common foreign and security policy. And I probably also said that, on the other hand, we would also be able to contribute to the shaping and also to the implementation of the European policies in this respect. Now, of course, only 9 months after enlargement, it's very hard to give any balance of things. But what we can certainly say is on the one hand, Hungary and I suppose the other countries did get get closer to additional tools for modernization. And of course, what Kaya said about Estonia is, to perhaps a slightly lesser extent, also true for Hungary and the other countries, in the sense that in the last 5 years, we've had 4 to 5% GDP growth. And if we look at the analysis for the coming 5 years, not Hungarian analysis, but independent analysis outside Hungary, they say very much the same thing, which is about 5% average GDP growth over the next 5 years. And what they generally say is that for the eight Central and Central European new member countries, accession countries, it looks like, generally speaking, twice the GDP growth of the rest of the European Union over the next 5 years. And so it's important for us to have markets, an entirely free access on the markets for our goods, which of course we have. And it's also important to have, as Kaya also mentioned here, cohesion, structural and cohesion funds. And the balance in Hungary's case for the year 2004, we've just calculated, is a plus of 300 million euros for Hungary, which is not huge, but it's important. It's important because it does help the country modernize and build infrastructure in various parts of the country. So it certainly is, even in terms of money, it certainly is a positive balance. Now, as to the competitiveness of the European Union, actually, Kai already made mention of some of the aspects of corporate taxation. And if you have followed the debate, then you've certainly seen that most of our countries have, or maybe all of our countries, have lower corporate tax rates than not all, but most of the 15 old members of the European Union. And of course there is a debate, what nobody denies is that it did create competition within the European Union, competition for investment, and that and most economists say that this competition in investment does help the European economy. Just as more competition on the labour market would probably help the European economy, but we haven't seen much of it yet because of the many restrictions that are still there on the movement of labour within the European Union, and also because even in countries like Stefan referred to in the case of the United, well, between the United Kingdom and the Czech Republic, even in the case of countries which liberalised to a significant extent, in some respects entirely, their labour market, there has been no huge inflow of labour from any of our countries. More competition, which also means better competitiveness in the European economy. As for the foreign policy side, as I said, we were looking for a stronger say in what's going on in Europe and in the European neighbourhood, and I think we did get this. Of course, this is still on an intergovernmental basis in common foreign and security policy. Some of us feared that especially new and smaller countries might have a lesser say than not so new and not so small countries. But based on 9 months of experience, I can say if and when we really know what we want to achieve, there is a possibility to achieve not necessarily all of it, but a significant part of what we're looking for. And of course, our interest is especially in Eastern Europe and Southeastern Europe, the immediate neighborhood of the European Union, both of these regions being, of course, immediately adjacent to Hungary. And what we've seen in those 9 months is that we did have not just an opportunity, but I would say almost an obligation to to share our analysis of the situation with our partners in the European Union, and that our partners in the European Union were more than happy to ask for our views and for our ideas as to what may be done. And of course, we also hoped, we were sure, actually, in many ways, that there would be a lot more emphasis on European policies vis-à-vis these East and Southeast European countries after the 10 countries join. And this happened. And we also hoped that this emphasis would also create a stronger action of the European Union in these countries. And this has also happened, not just because European neighborhood is now, does include East and Southeast Europe, but also because of all that happened in some of the countries of these regions. And if you look at the possibilities of the 10 accession countries, the new member countries contributing to European policies, it is enough to look at what happened in the Ukraine and to look at the role that especially Poland, but also some other new countries, including Hungary, played trying to help a positive and certainly peaceful outcome of the political crisis in the Ukraine, which I think outcome which all of us are very happy about. And another thing is although that is slightly less in the limelight, much of the same happens with regard to the other huge area of neighborhood policy, which of course is also an area and even more so an area of enlargement policy, which is Southeastern Europe, where Hungary and Slovenia are playing a pivotal role in contributing to and even to an extent and in some issues shaping the policies of the European Union. So there again, I think we have gained through our membership in the European Union, and we've also been able to contribute to policies of the European Union in these various fields. Two words on two other issues. One is something you may be interested in. I don't want to talk at length about it now. If you're interested, I'm sure all of us will be happy to talk about it later. Enlargement. We are for further enlargement of the European Union. In other words, we are not just seeking solidarity for ourselves, and we haven't just been seeking solidarity for ourselves before joining the European Union, but we're also willing to offer solidarity to those who are seeking to come after us, which is one thing, and this has a strong support in Hungarian society. According to the latest Eurobarometer polls, 59% of Hungarians supported further enlargement of the European Union, which doesn't mean that 41% oppose this, because you have two other categories, those who oppose and those who don't really know or don't really have an opinion. So 59% is very, very strong, I think, by European standards. And the other thing is just to reflect very briefly on what Kaya said about the so-called financial perspectives, that is to say the European Union's budget over the 7 years between 2007 and 2013. Yes, there are two distinct schools, the 1% school and the 1.24% school, this latter represented by the Commission. Hungary has always said is that if we are serious about the European Union, and if we are serious about the policies of the European Union, not just the old ones that we know, and of course we know that now we have 25 countries and not 15, but also if we are serious about the evolution of the policies of the European Union and some of the new policies, and that is to say some of the new requirements of old or new policies, If you look at justice and home affairs, if you look at foreign policy, if you look at everything that is related to migration and all the rest, then you cannot think that 1%, which is the level which European expenses have reached, going down, because they were much higher. Let's not forget that. You can't really think that 1% is sufficient for all these. So I'm sure Kaya is right, and the truth, as usual, will be somewhere in between. But I'm pretty sure it cannot be and will not be 1%. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Cesare Cole would continue, please.
Thank you very much. Well, in a way, I'm in quite a privileged position because my colleagues already presented all the major issues that are of our common interest. So perhaps I would like to just briefly present a Polish perspective as such. Well, obviously, it's just 9 months since we all joined European Union, so it's a bit too early to have any conclusive remarks regarding the impact. But I would say that the general perception in Poland is that it's been a historic and historically positive event. And it also helped us to somehow discredit many false predictions, fears, and concerns that were quite common both in Poland and outside Poland as well. So first of all, it has turned out that the accession of Poland and 9 other states did not undermine the political cohesion of the European Union. And Poland in particular, that was the case during the accession negotiations, that were quite often being described as a possible Trojan horse in the European Union. And that is definitely not the case. And we in my opinion, managed to become quite an active member of the European Union. And especially, as my colleague mentioned, in the case of Ukraine, we were able to prove that we are in the European Union actually to add some extra value, not just wait for financial support. And another crucial issue for us in Poland also has been the very positive response of the social group that was probably, to put it mildly, not very enthusiastic about joining the European Union, namely Polish farmers. So far, it's definitely one of the most successful stories of Polish membership in the Union. First of all, we were quite capable of absorbing the funds available, which was not that sure during the negotiations. And our farmers are now in the forefront of supporting European integration. So from this point of view, one of the most major obstacles towards ratification of the constitutional treaty has been removed. Because according to most recent public opinion polls, roughly 60% of public opinion supports the idea of approving the referendum. Obviously, the other issue is the turnout, which is always a bit risky thing in case of Poland, because we have this constitutional requirement to have at least 50% of turnout. Otherwise, the referendum will not be valid. So basically, these are the two main issues that are quite obvious after 9 months of our membership. If I may, I would like also to present as briefly as possible our priorities in the European Union. The first one I already mentioned, it's the constitutional treaty. We will probably have a referendum on the constitutional treaty later this year, probably in September. I won't go into details regarding the new financial perspective obviously, as most of the new member states, we are somewhere in the middle between the 1% club and the Commission proposals. Obviously, one of the areas in the European Union which are of great interest to us is the Lisbon agenda. Basically, we are very much in favor of actually realizing the provisions of this policy, basically improving the competitiveness and, free market within the Union. And also something that we are quite good at, not only in Poland, but also in the region, is something that is sometimes called so-called European Eastern Dimension. And obviously our participation in the Ukraine crisis is a proof that that's something that we could really add to the European Union. So basically, I would like to finish by saying that despite the relatively short time after joining the Union, the general impact is obviously quite positive. And the most important thing probably is a very positive response of public opinion, which is always crucial in Poland and in other countries as well. So basically, we are in Europe to be an active member, probably presenting some new policies or modernized policies that take into account our experience and our expertise in the region. And obviously, we are quite open to any coalitions within the European Union based on common interest. But actually, we are not that keen of creating any small organized groups or so-called hardcore Europe. So basically, that's the very general evaluation of our experience so far, and I am more than happy to raise some more specific issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much. His Excellency, Ambassador of Slovenia.
Yeah, everything has been already said, so it's very difficult to speak after four speakers. I can, regarding the EU enlargement 9 months after, on general EU frame, political frame, we could say that we are having now a stable EU frame. And after enlargement and positive estimations of the enlargement, I'm saying this because it seems to me that some anxiousness existed on both sides before the enlargement, what will happen after the 1st of May of 2004. We could see anxiousness in the old members, but also we could notice some skepticism before entering in the new members. I can see that now there is a substantial satisfaction with the enlargement. I can see probably on both sides. We've gone through common projects, also meaning EU election we carried out. Unfortunately, with marked with a low turnout, especially in the new member states, and common product of the new and old members is the constitutional treaty, which have to be ratified yet in most countries. In Slovenia, we will do this on the 1st of February 2005. There has been some differences also between old and new members in 2004, marked by policies regarding Iraq, also relation to Russia, views on the national sovereignty, and debate on the corporate tax as late as one, corporate tax rates in the new member states. If I'm talking in general regarding economic side of the European Union, I can see positive economic frame after the enlargement. The trade between new and old member states is growing, also between the new member states among themselves. Especially we can notice the growth in tourism. Slovenia is, for example, since 1st of May, is noticing the growth from tourists from UK for 44%. And what is very important is heavy increase of the importance of the transport and infrastructural connections between East and West. Significant investments for the East-West connections, meaning the 10 projects, this is transport and energy networks, are to be made, especially for the Eastern Europe. Much bigger foreign direct investments, probably in both ways, are still missing. Maybe, this is my personal view, maybe new members should enter to Eurozone more rapidly, but the opinions are very different. If I'm concentrating on Slovenia, well, we should know that in Slovenia we had threefold transition, meaning, and this is the difference from the other candidate countries for the EU. In Slovenia, we had a transition from the ex-SFRI republic to the independent country in 1991, from market-type socialist economy to functioning market economy from 1992 to 1996, and from independent state to efficient EU member in 1996 till 2004. Well, this is the difference, because in Slovenia, the accession negotiations and process to EU, it has been strongly connected to the transition processes, meaning accession procedures speeded the transition reforms in Slovenia, but they were also connected to the nation or state building process in Slovenia. So we have to perform double or triple efforts on the way, on the path towards EU. Especially because there was quite a lot of questioning. Slovenia became independent country in 1991, and there was a lot of questioning whether we should give up the sovereignty after such a short period of independence. But Slovenes decided in vast majority to do so. In a referenda regarding entering EU in March 2004, we had 89.6% yes vote for the European Union, and mainly this is a consequence because Slovenes wanted to return to the community of common values, but also to get out of the turmoils in the Balkans, especially under Milosevic's era. If I'm talking about the political picture in Slovenia, is that despite the government that led Slovenia into the European Union lost the elections in October 2004, the positive inclination of Slovenes towards EU is staying very high. And this is a consequence of the fact that as already mentioned, the project of entering into EU and NATO has been a national project, an agreement between the opposition and government. This is important because we are trying to export, if I may so say so, the model of strengthening the political forces also to Western Balkans countries, because for speeding the preparations on the path towards EU, the political unity is very much needed inside the country. If I'm talking about the economic picture in Slovenia after the EU, since 1993 till 2003, Slovenia has doubled the GDP per capita. What is to be considered as a big economic success? It's differently from Ireland, which had similar success decade ago, but Slovenia has achieved this success before it had entered into the European Union and without European funding. GDP per capita is nowadays on the level, more or less on the level of Greece and Portugal. But we are trying to use our membership in the European Union, of course, to speed the growth of the GDP. The main economic indicators in Slovenia are in the frame of required Maastricht criteria. The only problem nowadays is inflation rate. We managed to cut the inflation to 3.5% at the end of 2004, And we are the expectation are that the inflation will be stabilized on the something in the 3% in 2005. In June, we entered the system of ERM2 with an end to become euro to come to the eurozone in 2007. And 66% of Slovenes are supporting the entering to eurozone very fast. We are fulfilling also the rules of the fiscal convergence. I have a lot of figures here, but if someone will be interested, I will explain them later. Macroeconomic indicators in 2004 were good. Economic or GDP growth was more than 4%. Estimations at the end of 2004 was 4.9. In 2003, we had just 2.2 growth. And the growth is a consequence partially of the effect of entering in the EU, but also by the very high expectation of companies regarding the EU membership. The main factor of uncertainty are still all oil prices. Trade exchange after enlargement with the EU 25 is growing, also with the UK, especially export and import is falling down. The export growth in 2004 was for Slovenia 8.5%. And regarding GDP per capita purchasing parity power, Slovenia is exceeding the 77 of the EU 25 average GDP, or 70% of EU 15. And it is now on 17,100 euro GDP per capita purchasing parity power, but it could be combined with Spain, Cyprus, Portugal, and Malta. The unemployment rate is under the EU average, and it is 6.4, or the latest figures, I think, 5.8 at the end of 2004. We faced in the economy, we faced a major problem, and this is that Slovenia has taken over the common foreign and trade policy, and because of that, we should give up the free trade agreements with the Eastern countries and Southeastern European countries. But despite that, the trade exchange of Slovenia is on export level 66% of all exports with the EU, and 78% of all imports is with EU. Foreign direct investments in Slovenia are still low, so Slovenia is a net exporter of foreign direct investments, especially in Southeastern Europe. We also faced budgetary problems because the VAT falling down after entering European Union. VAT meaning tax revenues decreased into the budget. What are the conclusions after 9 months? On general, the EU accession process and membership has enabled faster economic and political transition and reforms in Slovenia. Accession assured greater stability of economy and democratic society, as well as enabled social consensus regarding very painful economic reforms. EU means a large market for Slovenian companies. It brings more competition into Slovenian economy. But the most important is the community of common values that we wishes to belong. Despite that, EU project of enlargement is still under the trademark to be a project of the elites. One of the biggest achievements is a greater social mobility between European citizens, and it is especially because of possibilities on the educational level, meaning each European citizen could choose schools all around Europe, and you are the best example here to be pointed out. In Slovenia, we feared, there were a lot of fears regarding identity and language, in the European Union. But nowadays we could see that Slovene national sovereignty, cultural identity, values and language in the EU are not endangered. In fact, they could be enriched. Slovenian language is one of the 20th equal EU languages. I'm saying this because Slovenia is a small one. It's 2 million country, 2 million population country, but we are very much keen on our culture and language. Slovenia became co-creator of the EU policy. It moved from the periphery to the core of the EU, into the decision-making process, and by this Slovenia obtained greater weight, not just in Europe, but also in the global processes. Our citizens got the rights that other EU citizens have them, free movement of persons, right to complain to the European Court of European Communities. And what is very much important for Slovenia is that Slovenian minorities living across the border have become a part of a single Slovenian cultural space inside the EU. And they come closer to mother state since the borders in the EU are now very soft. EU is positive for the development of minorities, and the minorities should be no longer treated as a point of dispute between the states. There is also we can also notice the boost of the regional and transfrontal cooperation, meaning Euro regions are developing very fast, and they are promoting the economic cooperation. And one of the most and crucial important gains from the EU is for Slovenia is the improvement of the relations with neighboring Austria and Italy. With Hungary we had good relations, but with Austria and Italy we had historically burdened, meaning the second World War especially. And since we joined the EU, we noticed a big improvement of the relations with our neighbors, what is also the basic idea of the EU. Students got the possibility to choose the schools. And what are the objectives of Slovenia in EU further? If I may, one sentence about the problems. We were very much disappointed regarding, like my colleagues said, regarding the transitional period for free movement of labor force. Well, Slovenia is not particularly a country of emigration. On the contrary, the living standard in Slovenia is quite high, and they do not like to move. We are afraid more on brain drain from Slovenia. Objectives of Slovenia in EU is fulfilling the criteria to obtain euro in 2005. New financial perspective. We would like to the negotiations will be concluded by the June. It will be difficult, but this is because we are still in the average EU average that we would be a net receiver from the European Union in the frame of 1.3 or 1.36 GDP. I mentioned already the ratification of the Constitutional Treaty on the 1st of February. In 2007, if the Constitutional Treaty would be ratified, Slovenia will be in the first group to preside the European Union together with Germany and Portugal. We entering into Schengen system 2007, enlargement to Western Balkans, Slovenia together with Hungary and other regional states would like to place Western Balkans again to the agenda of the European Union. We are talking nowadays about the membership of the Turkey, already about the Ukraine. We are hearing something, and the Western Balkan is a natural doorstep and the shortest infrastructural way between two poles of the European Union, namely between Greece and Hungary or Greece and Slovenia. It should be the also economic interest to bring as soon as possible Western Balkans to the European Union, of course, by implementing all the conditions that are needing. Implementation of Lisbon strategy is very much important, and that will be short. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now I would like to open the discussion to the floor. So if any of you may have any questions, please raise your hand. Go ahead, gentleman in the back. Please, a mic will be given to you, and please introduce yourself. If you're studying at LSE, say which course you're studying, so just to make it slightly more clear.
Okay. I'm a PhD student in international relations, and I'm doing research on the Charter of Fundamental Rights of the European Union. And my question is related to the Charter as well. I have an egoistic purpose in asking it. In the year 2000, the European Union was drafting the Charter. I mean, I'm sure most of you will be aware. And then at that point, your countries were still applicant states. So they were invited to give oral evidence. So I don't know how is it. They were invited to have an audition with the drafting convention of the Charter. And among them, Hungary and Slovenia proposed that the Charter include certain minority rights provisions. Now, these suggestions were not taken on board by the drafting convention. The Charter doesn't include any minority rights provisions. So my question is, first of all, and the question is obviously to the ambassadors of Slovenia and Hungary, what made your countries, to the extent to which you're aware, of course, what made your country suggest those norms, make such a suggestion, and also how was the refusal to incorporate them perceived back in your capitals, in your governments? And the third following question is, what are you doing? What are your governments doing at the moment when you're already members of the European Union to push forward the incorporation of such norms, minority rights protection norms, within the normative order of the Union? Thank you.
Well, we suggested this because we think it's important. It's important because there are lots of minorities, ethnic and other, in Central and Eastern Europe, and of course it was especially important for Hungary, a country that has some tangible minorities within the country, and also a very tangible Hungarian minorities beyond our borders in practically all the neighboring countries. So we thought that it was important to include this in a European Union document. And of course the other reason is, if you remember so well the accession process, is that part of the so-called Copenhagen criteria was also the respect for human rights, generally speaking, including the rights of minorities. So we thought that if it was obviously important for the European Union to protect minority rights, then it is just as well that it is included in a document of the European Union. And, this was the background of the suggestion we made at the time. And as you say, it is not part of the Charter of Fundamental Rights. There is a reference, and this is the first such reference in any document of the European Union. There is a reference to minority rights in the preamble of the Constitutional Treaty of the European Union, which, of course, has not entered into force yet. But I very much hope that with the help of this country, among others, it will enter into force in the near future, that is to say in about two and a half years from now. I think it's in the second article or the first article of the preamble which states that human rights, including minority rights, will be protected in the European Union.
I can hardly add something. We proposed this in the time of a convention. Why? Because Slovenia is thinking that minority rights are one of the most important rights. Not just in Slovenia. We would like to see also the European Union to protect. Why? In Slovenia there are two minorities. It is a Hungarian minority and Italian minority. Both of them, they are having seat in the parliament. And constitutional protection, and a lot of Slovene minorities they are living in Hungary, in Austria and Italy, are living abroad. So Slovenia has a lot of experience with the minorities. and European Union is meant to be a protection force of minorities as a basic of democracy nowadays. And because of that, we supported also during the negotiations for the constitutional treaty the mentioning, at least in the preamble, the reference to the minority rights, as Hungarian colleague already said.
Thank you. Any further questions? Go ahead, please. Lady in the green.
Thank you all for coming. My name is Lynn Fogarty. I'm a master's student in regulation here at LSE. And my question is, how do any of you see your relationship having been affected or will be affected with non-European neighborhood nations in general and the United States in particular by your membership in the EU and closer relations with France and Germany, namely? Thank you.
Who would like to answer this? Or do you have anybody specifically in your mind to answer it, or just generally the whole panel?
Well, perhaps I should start as a representative of an allegedly a Trojan horse in Europe. Well, basically, we've argued from the very beginning, even during the accession negotiations, that there is no contradiction whatsoever, to our mind at least, between having and enjoying good relations with the United States and at the same time being a good and a full member of the European Union. And in this respect, we are very close to the position of this country. And actually, we think that we've managed to prove that during the last 9 months, that I'm not hesitating to describe it as a privileged relation with the United States has not in any way armed our position in the European Union. On the other hand, we think that that's something that could be quite helpful, and we are very much for promoting better understanding and actually strengthening transatlantic relations. Because at the end of the day, obviously, there are differences they were in the past and they will be in the future. But basically, we must remember that both United States and European Union, European nations, actually, we are preaching the same values, and that's, I think, the best platform to somehow develop it in the future. So that's the general answer.
I think. Would you like to comment on it, please?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well. Actually, I quite agree with my colleague from Poland here, and I don't really have anything to add as for the relations with the United States, but you kindly mentioned other non-European countries. So I suspect sooner or later Russia will come up in this debate, so let's tackle it now. And obviously, being one of the Baltic countries, we are probably one of the countries most often this question is posed to you. What about your relations with Russia? And they are interesting. They are certainly on the verge of improving. I mean, that's much better than to say that they are not normal, as Russia claims. But what we see at the moment is that with the European Union, with Russia's interests towards the European Union, we do see some significant steps forward. One of the, well, basically technical questions has been the absence of the border treaty between Estonia and Russia and Latvia and Russia. And actually, Lithuania has not got a ratified treaty either. So we have been obviously trying to move forward with this for years and years, but in the end, I mean, if Japan is able to live without a border treaty, so are we. But what we have seen now is that with Russia discussing on a constructive basis issues of visa movement, for example, issues of the other legal nature with the European Union. The European Union has clearly stated that one of the preconditions is an existing border treaty. And guess what? President Putin has invited us to sign it. So there is a lot of, let's put it this way, mixed signals still. And at the moment, we don't know if it's going to take place in the very near future, or do we have to go through some other complicated procedures yet. But I would certainly say that we already feel the positive impact of the European Union. And just one comment as for the relations with the United States. I mean, in the end, also, of course, Estonia being one of the staunchest allies and being present in Iraq and whatever, bearing this in mind, in the end, we have joined the European Union. It is the common policy of the European Union which will define our position towards the United States. And as long as there is an understanding both in the European Union and in the United States that this needs to be improved at the moment, I think we're on a right track.
If you look at the record and the potential of what the new members might bring, I mean, you can divide it into three. First element will be the element of reinforcing. The second will be element of adding actually new flavor to something already here. And third, actually adding a new subject. I explain. The first one, reinforcing. It is about the relationship between the EU and NATO, the relationship between the EU and the United States. And becoming a member of the NATO just recently, we did not become a member of the EU just to build a EU as a opposite structure to the United States and to NATO, which is in fact the best reflection of the transatlantic link. And we can debate for our where is the basis for this special relationship the Central Europeans feel towards the United States. But there's one single answer to it. I mean, it is record of the United States. It is the role of the United States in bringing the democracy to our countries. Then you have the second element or factor bringing something new, a new flavor. And here you have a wide range of the countries: China, arms embargo, Israel, finding a new framework for the European Union support of the Middle East process, taking into account the Israeli position in a little bit more balanced way. Okay, that might be something, for example, the Prague is sort of trying to do. And it might be also Russia, quite correctly, as Kaya said. The third one is bringing new subjects on the screen of radars. The countries which have not been here before. And Ukraine, fantastic example. Moldova, another one waiting. Georgia. And I might continue. So it's a complex of the issue. I think that by enlarging the European Union, the European Union sort of put on the board not only us, but our relationship, our experience, our history, and that encompasses all these three factors.
Thank you very much. Any more questions? Would you like to comment on it as well?
Yes, just if you are a member of European Union, that does not mean that you have to choose two sides. The important one is the dialogue. I'm referring this to transatlantic relations, what the Polish colleague explained, the transatlantic relations, but also Russia. For example, Slovenia improved the relations. We had very good relations even before with Russia, but during our membership, we just improved the relations with Russia. We've been affected on the economic side, for example, with the relations, economic relations with the countries of Western Balkans and also Eastern Europe. as I mentioned before, because we have to give up the free trade agreements with that countries, and to the quotas has been diminished on the expense of the EU for Slovenia. But at the same time, we strengthened the political relations, because Slovenia could play much more greater role for the countries in the region, also bilaterally, on their path towards European Union. So the relationship, the membership in the European Union could foster the bilateral relations of the member countries as well.
Thank you. If you may, from the middle, please deliver a mic there.
Good. Sense of ambiguity.
Okay, I'm on a Master in European Studies at King's College. I would like to go back to the issue of minorities to talk about general European citizenship. You mentioned something about minorities. Do you think you are united all together, all these countries which have come together, in pressing for the respect of rights of minorities, which doesn't imply just minorities like Hungarian minority, for example, which is spread around Romania, all these countries, or minority in Slovenia, but for example, Russian minority, which is in Estonia, in a way in which you are on the border of Europe now, many of you, so you will have more and more influx from Ukraine, Russia, people trying to come into Europe before these countries can eventually accede the European Union. So are you pushing all together for these rights of minorities, which might improve also relation with neighboring countries? The long-standing issue, for example, Transylvania or Russian in Estonia.
And who are you addressing your question to? To the whole panel.
Yeah.
And I'll leave it again up to my two colleagues who already answered the similar question. But even if it does not seem to be the case from London, the region of Central and Eastern Europe is a region where you have quite different set of countries with a different historical experience. And working in the Lithuania, I always hate to hear how the people refer to the Baltic region and the Baltic countries, not realizing that there is a huge difference between Lithuanians, Latvians, and Estonians. So how we differ historically, also our policies differs, including the policy of the minority. So to say that we have so sort of very common, if not unified, position on minority rights, it's not the case. It does not mean that the Czechs and others are absolutely against what the Hungarians are pushing. Well, it says it's about the priorities. It's about the priorities which are in a little bit different order in Prague than they are in Budapest and other countries.
May I just comment a little bit further on this difference? There is a legal distinction in European law between indigenous minorities and between recent immigrants. And I'm not saying that recent immigrants should not be enjoying all sorts of basic human rights, social rights, and so on. But at the moment, when we're talking about the Charter of Fundamental Rights, for example, we are talking about the rights of indigenous ethnic minorities. So that's also something to remember.
Well, coming to minorities, I mean, you may remember that when I first spoke, I talked about Hungarian minorities abroad, but also non-Hungarian minorities within the country. First thing is, I just want to repeat what Kajataja just said about the difference between indigenous and migrant minorities, which is an important difference. Second is, of course, when we talk about minority rights, we are not just thinking about Hungarian minorities in neighboring countries, but we are also thinking about minorities within Hungary. And we are thinking about the same type of rights, not necessarily the same rights, because it depends on so many things. I mean, the numbers, the concentration, and lots of other things. But basically, what we've been suggesting for quite a long time is first thing, and this is part of every European document, of course, which is not to suffer any discrimination because you belong to a minority, and this is essential. The second is, if you claim to belong to a minority community, then to have the possibility, the right to foster your identity no matter where you live, which involves some cultural rights, which involves some educational rights, which of course involves all the freedoms that belong to everyone, like religion and information, but also in your own language. And it does involve a certain degree of autonomy. And then again, what type and what degree of autonomy depends to a large extent on which country, what possibilities, and also what conditions we are talking about. So the notion of minority rights is extremely important, but the practical implication does differ from one country to another. But what we think is it is important in many of these countries, and it is also important in some of the future member countries of the European Union, where, again, the question is, are we going to see the evolution, the rise of multicultural societies, or are we going to see tentatives, peaceful or not so peaceful, to establish monolithic countries with some of the consequences that we've already seen in the last 10 years.
Thank you. Any further questions? If you may, from the top, please.
Surprise elements. Now, I have to say that translating all 80,000 pages of Aki before the 1st of May, none of us really was of the surprising nature. Where the element of the surprise might be is the huge flexibility, absolute lack of any order in creating ad hoc coalition within the European Union to push this or that idea through. How complex it is, how extremely complex and difficult it is to know that once you push button A, that you get the result B, and once you push the button epsilon, I mean, you get quite a different result. That is something where we are still sort of in the learning mood.
Any other surprises?
Well, I would say that the accession negotiations were quite painful. So basically, we've all lost our, how should I put it, innocence and our idealistic approach to the European Union during the negotiations. So there were relatively fewer surprises after the 1st of May. So the positive side of this approach is that probably just by the end of the negotiations, we were slightly suspicious that somehow we may end up as second-class members of the European Union. This has not happened. So that's very positive development. But I would repeat once again that after the negotiations, there were relatively few surprises for us. Obviously, as Stefan mentioned, we are relatively new and not very experienced in the internal dealings of the European Union. So that's something that we will probably have to learn quite painfully during the process. But that's basically it. There are relatively few unpleasant surprises.
Well, may I just say that the biggest surprise is in store for all of us with the UK referendum coming up. And let's just hope it will be a positive surprise. Because you can't even imagine what's going to happen in the European Union if the UK is going to say no, which is, of course, quite probable at the moment. But the legal consequences of this no and the political consequences for Europe is really something beyond our imagination. And this applies both to new and old members.
Thank you. If you may have two more questions as time is passing.
And let me make one important remark, addition to what Kaya said, because she made that reference not only because no would cause a constitutional problem. She also made that comment because we all believe, and I'm sure, that the country like the UK with its pragmatism, which is liberalism, is very much needed within the European Union. We belong to the countries which understand the phrase that the enlargement made the UK more British friendly, and we don't lose that feeling and understanding.
Hello, I'm Kasia Grevich, and I'm studying at LSE. I would like to ask a question about neighbor relationships. Poland took an active part in guiding the discussions in Ukraine, and some of the EU countries did not show a very strong support to that opinion, I would say, being afraid of spoiling relationships with Russia. What is the Poland's view on the situation, and what is the other ambassador's view on, from the other perspective, how it should look like, and how would you behave in similar situations here?
Thank you.
Well, perhaps I should start again. Well, basically, we are in no way unpleasantly surprised by the reaction of our fellow member states, as we explained a bit earlier. It's just a question of your priorities in the European Union. Obviously, for us, being a neighboring country, it's a top priority because that's a huge country just in front of our doorstep. So we are very much interested in having a stable, democratic Ukraine as a neighboring country. And I wouldn't say that we haven't received enough support from other member states. This absolutely does not apply to our fellow new member states. And if we can look for support and understanding, that's definitely the first place to ask our fellow new entrants. Well, again, I wouldn't read too much into this lack of support. Obviously, we were quite enthusiastic about the whole issue, and we're quite keen to get involved as soon as possible. But that was just because of our expertise in dealing with Ukraine. So we are very happy about the end result. And obviously, as I mentioned before, we can easily expect other so-called all member states to be probably more interested in what's happening in North Africa. That's only natural. So that's the question of priorities, I would say.
Well, if I may add, I would rather say that I was pleasantly surprised by the support of the member states because I think Poland and also the High Representative for Foreign Policy, Javier Solana, took the lead in many ways. But I think what was most important is that the EU member countries, together or taken separately, did not cave in and held the line, which was not to come out in support of one or another candidate at the elections in the Ukraine, but simply to say we cannot accept an election which is tainted by fraud. And actually the fact that the European Union held the line, and of course, remembering some other questions about the United States, that the United States also held the line, and also very forcefully, as you may remember, helped a positive outcome of the elections in the end, and helped basically some. We'll see how radical, but certainly very positive changes in the Ukraine, which I think also did away with a lot of prejudices, which would state that Ukraine is fundamentally different from the rest of Europe. Because it did show that Ukrainians, in the end, are not that fundamentally different. And it did show that their end goal is not just the same as the end goal of many of us, but that they are also capable of advancing towards that end goal. So I think the important thing was that the European Union, I will not say without any hesitation, I will not say that everybody thought the same from the very beginning, but they did keep to the same general line, and they did keep to that general line as long as it was sufficient to wait out the good outcome of the events in the Ukraine.
And if I may say, it not just European Union, it has been there also OSCE. I'm saying this, supporting the democratic processes in the Ukraine and holding the line also during the Bulgarian presidency, but also during Slovenian, because Slovenia took the presidency on the 1st of January, and right after the first trip of our chairman in office, minister was to Ukraine to give the support for the democratic processes down there.
And can I also mention an implication of these events on our relationship to Russia? When we were about to finalize our accession discussions, whether it was in the framework of the European Union or in the framework of NATO, there was always a drive to reach a consensus on the particular issue or the particular policy between the EU or NATO on one side and the Russia on the other side. But then always some of the EU or NATO countries played that kind of policy bilaterally. And sometimes not always within the framework adopted within this particular organization. The situation we face today is, and I recognize that it's not just because of the newcomers like us, it's also because of the new Russia, if you like, Putin's policy in the close neighborhood. But today you have, for the first time in NATO, discussions on Russia, about Russia, about what's going on, how we look at it. You have the same discussion within the European Union. For the first time, we have at least two basic different opinions about how to proceed in our relationship with Russia. One sort of stressing the critical dialogue or critical cooperation, if you'd like. Others stressing the need first to iron out the differences and then sort of go ahead. So I think we contributed humbly into this process, which I think at the end will not be harmful, but will be helpful in understanding our big partner on the East.
Thank you. I remember I said two more questions. I'm really sorry, we're very short on time. Their agenda is very, very full, and their one of our panelists will need to go. Please, do you understand that? But keep in mind that there will be an event following this one, and besides this one, panelists, everybody will follow us there. This is in the nearby bar, George King IV, so you're more than welcome to come there and have your questions asked and hopefully answered as well. So thank you very much for coming, and for all of you to show such a great interest in the issues of the newly joined EU members. On behalf of the audience, if I may, and on my behalf and the society's behalf, let me thank our panelists for coming today and delivering such an insightful discussion, showing the main factors, the draft EU constitution, tax regime, labor force, future enlargement, pressing issues with the relations of Russia, Ukraine, for example, all of which, as we can understand, are significant factors defining the competitiveness of the European Union in the global economy. So thank you very much for coming, for all of you. Please give a applause for